The Guardian.
The government changes its slogan and creates a mixed message. I'm Jonathan Friedland, columnist at The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
I can announce today that the job retention scheme will be extended for 4 months until the end of October.
On Tuesday, many businesses and employees were pleasantly surprised to hear the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, announce an extension to the furlough scheme till the end of October. The Treasury will continue to pay employers 80% of their workers' wages until the end of July, and then from August, it'll put in place provisions for workers to return on a part-time basis. The wage subsidy programme is currently costing taxpayers about £14 billion a month, and Sunak was adamant that the scheme will stop at the end of October. So, has he done enough to save the UK economy from a complete collapse? And what lies ahead for those self-employed people who were never eligible for the scheme in the first place? Whatever else, Sunak's announcement was clear, which is more than you could say for the message from his neighbour in Downing Street. The Prime Minister caused quite the stir on Sunday night when he announced he would be extending lockdown, but that some employees should expect to go back to work as soon as the very next morning. The announcement, coupled with a new slogan, "Stay alert, control the virus, save lives," caused instant confusion, leaving government ministers scrambling to explain exactly what it was they wanted us to do. Someone who got an unexpected chance to make his position clear on the current crisis was the leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer. First with a splash in The Telegraph, house journal of the Tory party with a direct line to the Conservative Party membership, and then on the BBC, where on Monday evening he presented his formal response to the Prime Minister's lockdown speech. So, are there lessons to be learned from this pandemic for both major parties on the art of communication? I'll be speaking to Andrew Jimpson and Aisha Hazarika about how government and opposition should be talking to each other and to the public. Plus, The Guardian columnist Simon Jenkins takes us back to the year 2000, when Londoners elected a mayor for the first time. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, it's week 8 of the UK's lockdown, and despite the Prime Minister's best efforts, if you want to be kind, a lot of us are still confused as to how the UK will actually exit lockdown. To discuss all the latest from Westminster, I'm joined on the line by The Guardian's political correspondent Peter Walker, who has very kindly bundled himself under a blanket, so the sound quality will be even better. Peter, you've been off writing a book for these last few weeks. Tell me, how have you found writing in these very strange times?
Kind of been almost the ideal lockdown thing because you're indoors chained to a laptop anyway, really. So, I mean, the weird thing is I don't think the last 4 or 5 weeks would have looked much different to me anyway.
All about timing when it comes to books. Now, let's look at what's been happening in Westminster. As you and I speak now, PMQ's Prime Minister's Questions has just wrapped up, where Keir Starmer was really turning the screw on Boris Johnson to explain things like, for example, this unexplained figure for excess deaths in care homes, some 10,000, which are not accounted for in the figures, and why the government decided to drop its use of, in the form of a slide, its international comparison slide. How did Boris Johnson do under that kind of pressure?
I didn't think he did particularly well. I mean, this new style Prime Minister's Questions, without all the kind of Tory loyalists cheering him on, and not really the ideal situation for Boris Johnson anyway. And I always thought during the Labour leadership campaign, I thought Keir Starmer would be quite a difficult leader for Johnson because Johnson is not really a details man. And he's suddenly facing this, you know, barrister who, if he knows anything, knows his brief perfectly well. But even this particular one, he didn't really have answers for quite a number of things. There was this row that Keir Starmer asked this very, very particular question as to why the government advised the care sector until March the 12th that a coronavirus outbreak was not a particularly likely thing. And Johnson basically said, oh, you know, no, that's actually not the case. But it is. I mean, the webpage is actually still there. And he didn't do really any better on any of the other questions. And I mean, the weird thing for me is that I don't think Boris Johnson looks completely well yet. I mean, I know that COVID can take quite a long time for people to get over a particularly bad case. So getting over that, having a newborn son and having to focus on all this is incredibly difficult. So, you know, I think he had a pretty tough time.
And the latest poll numbers, which if Labour MPs had been in the chamber, would have had them with a spring in their step, or if they'd been in there in big numbers. Latest poll numbers from YouGov show that Keir Starmer is more popular, or at least it has a higher sort of positive rating among voters than Boris Johnson for the very first time. Now, there's all kinds of caveats, always with opinion polls, of course. Very early days in the Starmer leadership, but should Johnson and his team be worried?
I think they're going to be worried anyway, because I think the way that the UK has gone through the coronavirus outbreak, there's going to be a lot of extremely serious questions to answer. I think having Keir Starmer as Labour leader is going to make that position even more difficult, because as PMQs just now showed, he's someone who kind of knows his brief and is very capable of answering detailed questions. What we don't yet know is how much this kind of lawyerly style will either fit into a kind of noisier comments, and also how much it actually cuts through. That, you know, if you're a political journalist watching it, you think, oh, wow, that was great. But it doesn't necessarily make the kind of noisy social media clips that Jeremy Corbyn was very good at doing. So, you know, it very much remains to be seen. And Starmer is taking over at an incredibly difficult time. It's very difficult to get kind of cut through in the media when the government is holding a kind of nationally televised press conference every single night.
We're talking of nationally televised events. Let's go back to Sunday evening. There has been quite a lot of criticism, not just about the content, which we might talk about, but just that even the fact that Johnson went ahead with this speech, that it was pre-recorded, that fellow cabinet ministers weren't up to speed with what he was going to announce, and of course the traditional objection that MPs in the House of Commons do prefer to be told these things first, and the Speaker always is very particular about that. All those issues, as I say, besides the content, has that caused some friction at a time when the government actually really doesn't need it?
I think it does. And again, this might be the stuff that doesn't necessarily resonate with the public much, but Boris Johnson has got to keep the Conservative backbenchers on side. And he's got to keep his ministers on side too. And there were plenty of reports of ministers who were not very, very pleased at all when they found out that a lot of the message had been pre-recorded before the cabinet meeting, or rather the virtual cabinet meeting at which they were going to talk about it, took place. And, you know, this is very much rubbing their noses in the fact that they're not actually getting to make the choices. And in terms of presenting stuff to Parliament, again, you know, I don't think necessarily the public care that much. But if Conservative MPs were already very, very restless about the length of the lockdown, or, you know, certainly some of them are, anything else that annoys him even more is not really going to be very good for him.
Now, we reported on this podcast last week that the devolved governments of Northern Ireland and Scotland and Wales were teetering on the edge of going their own way. And it seems as if that was right, and that we are now in a four-nation world in the UK. Our colleague Martin Kettle tweeted after Boris Johnson had finished speaking that on this day, Sunday, Boris Johnson ceased to be the Prime Minister of the UK and became the Prime Minister of England alone. I mean, it does seem as if that's sort of right, doesn't it?
It very much does. And again, one of the curiosities of the address to the nation on Sunday evening that Johnson gave was he was stressing this is a UK-wide, you know, thing. And it's very much not. I mean, even before he talked, the Scottish devolved government made it very, very clear that they were going to keep the messaging of people should stay where they are and not go out as much. You know, it's possible you could be doing something perfectly legal in England, you know, cross over the River Wye into Wales, and you're doing something you're not meant to. It's a difficult situation, but it doesn't make it any easier.
Now, amazingly, in this environment, one very senior cabinet minister has managed to get continuously good notices, good reviews, and that is the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak. I mean, we're talking about unclear messages. He did at least come with a message of some clarity this week, Peter.
Yes, I mean, you know, not everybody spends their 40th birthday having to address a national crisis in a parliamentary speech. But the notices for him have been quite good. He announced that the furlough scheme is going to be extended to October. And, you know, this has been welcomed by pretty much everyone. But again, the only caveat for that is this is costing an enormous amount of money. It's costing billions of pounds every single month. And at some point, as long as he stays in the job, Sunak's going to have to try and find a way to pay for all this.
So in a way, you mean this is the easy bit, shelling out all the money. It's going to be afterwards finding and paying the bill that's going to be politically harder for him. The note of criticism comes from the failure to mention the few self-employed who aren't eligible for any of the different schemes. Those who start in business from early April last year will miss out, as will those who pay themselves only with dividends from a limited company. How has he been responding to that criticism, that there are some categories of people who are left behind?
I mean, this is a difficult thing, and self-employed people have, you know, for in some ways necessary reasons, found all this applying for kind of government grants and schemes that much more difficult. Sunak has to an extent acknowledged there's an issue with it. And, you know, with these kind of schemes, there is a kind of whack-a-mole element to it. The moment you announce something, people say, well, hang on, you've missed out this particular class of people. It's more difficult because the HMRC records for these people are often either less complete or not there. So it's difficult to know how much money they should be getting. But, you know, the Treasury has promised they will do something. We'll have to wait and see.
The backdrop to all of this was filled in this morning, Wednesday morning, as you and I talked. The Office for National Statistics released figures showing that the UK economy had shrunk by 2% in the first 3 months. So this is not a projection. This is actually what did happen in the first 3 months of the year. Grant Shapps, the Transport Secretary, he was doing the broadcast round, and he admitted that the UK was definitely heading for, if it wasn't already in, a recession. And now on top of all that, because obviously most of that first quarter was pre-coronavirus, really, these schemes are going to cost the Treasury billions and billions, as you've been saying. When the immediate crisis has passed, there will be this question of how they pay this enormous bill. Do you have a sense of how the political argument is shaping up among Tory MPs, whether they would prefer to pay for that with tax rises or spending cuts? And we know that when it comes to the latter option, spending cuts, the Prime Minister himself does not like the word austerity. He calls it the A word and was really keen not even to repeat it when it was put to him in one of those Downing Street briefings by Robert Peston, I think. How are they likely to frame whatever they're going to have to do in the end? And what are the sort of contours of the argument as you see them taking shape even right now?
I mean, if you talk to Tory MPs about this, they simply don't know what politically and realistically they can do. And to an extent, I think they're going to have to do a kind of a lot of politically unpalatable things and pretend as much as possible they're not doing them. You know, as Conservatives, they don't like tax rises, but that's going to have to happen in some format. 10 years ago, it would have been austerity and pay freezes. And those, again, are going to have to happen in some form. You know, there was this kind of leaked Treasury document which suggested pay freezes could be one way out of it. And there's been this immediate furious reaction from the police and NHS unions and, you know, things like that, making a perfectly good point of, you know, you're relying on this within the coronavirus outbreak. You're now going to, you know, make us live on nothing once it's done. And that would be politically very, very difficult. But then, again, if you're a Conservative government, living endlessly on a very, very, you know, high and rising debt isn't particularly easy either. So they're going to have to kind of, you would imagine, approach it from all fronts and try and trim bits here and there whilst, you know, pretending that not that much is actually being done. But I think, to be completely honest, the Treasury is going to be furiously plotting various ways they can do it, but I don't think they've even got an answer yet.
Peter, it's fabulous to have you back on the podcast. We're going to let you emerge from out and under that blanket of yours.
Yeah, into the fresh.
Providing studio quality, breathe some fresh air. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
After the break, we hear from Labour and Conservative commentators on how both sides of the political divide should interact with each other and with voters after the pandemic. Plus, Simon Jenkins gives us a history lesson on London mayoral elections. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Leia Green here. I want to tell you about a new podcast we're launching, and we'd like to get you involved. It's called All By Ourselves, and right now we're collecting personal stories about home, relationships, and how our lives changed in 2020.
The curtain goes round the coffin while you listen to some bit of Mozart or whatever it is, and that feels very strange.
He's got this like really weird thing in his head where he thinks like I'm like a witch.
So if you have something to share, big or small, funny or tragic, weird or wonderful, get in touch. email us on all.by.ourselves@theguardian.com or visit gu.com/ABO.
Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jonathan Friedland. At the weekend, the government launched a new slogan, the Stay at Home, Protect the NHS, Save Lives message that we'd all burnt into our cerebral cortex was exchanged, in England at least, for the more nuanced, some may even say more meaningless, Stay Alert, Control the Virus, Save Lives. The new slogan was slated by many, and the government was accused of presenting mixed messages to the public, causing confusion in a situation where clarity is imperative. Labour were quick to demand clarification, but the new leader of the party, Keir Starmer, continues to stick with his constructive opposition strategy, an approach that worries some in his party. So, is this pandemic bringing about fundamental change to how opposition politics will look in the future? To discuss all of this, on Monday, I brought together the editor of the Londoner's Diary column in the Evening Standard, the former Labour adviser Aisha Hazarika, and Andrew Jimpson, who knows better than most the mind and career of Boris Johnson. He's the Prime Minister's biographer and also a contributing editor to Conservative Home. Andrew Jimpson, before we get into how the two major parties in Westminster should be communicating with each other, should we just look a little bit at how they're communicating with the public? And the messaging from Downing Street, certainly as we speak, has been, it seems to me and plenty of others, an object lesson in how not to do it. I mean, this is a surprise, isn't it? Boris Johnson was meant to be the great communicator.
Well, I think there are always things which could be done better, but actually I think his broadcast last night, I think he has learned over the last month or two a new tone of voice, which the people who thought he was a sort of nothing but a buffoon thought he would never manage. I thought he sounded sober. And I think the wider public realizes that the whole thing is going to be rough around the edges because it is so incredibly imponderable. So I think you can always find details which aren't satisfactory. But I think overall, actually, he has a link with the wider public, which is pretty unusual in British politics.
I think it's hard to see how the government communications of all of this, you know, has just not been a kind of absolute shambles. And I think what's really surprising is that the government is actually quite good at slogans. It won the election on a slogan that, you know, Boris Johnson was part of the team that won Brexit on a slogan. And they seem to have just really misjudged this latest step. I mean, the original slogan, you know, stay home, save lives, protect the NHS, so crystal clear. And I think when you're doing public communications like this, a huge big public information campaign, and dealing with a huge crisis like this from a government point of view, the comms is not just an add-on. The comms is central to whether the strategy is going to be effective and confident. This is different from political campaigning. You know, Boris Johnson is brilliant at that stuff when you can take a bit of a punt, you can convince people with your sort of bluster and a bit of hope and a bit of optimism. He's your man for that. But where we are now, it does seem extraordinary that they were kind of announcing things that they just hadn't really done proper due diligence on or sort of stress tested some of the arguments. So I think the public can have affection for Boris Johnson, but I think the majority of the public are looking at things today and thinking, yeah, this has not been handled well.
Andrew, on that point then, is it the case that this man, you've studied him more closely really than anyone, is great, as Aisha was saying, the three-word slogans, take back control, get Brexit done. But when it comes to the details, he's just not comfortable with anything that is more nuanced and more subtle. And while, yes, he gets credit for being more sober in his demeanour, he's not able to give what was needed last night for public health messaging, which was quite a subtle and more detailed presentation.
He's having to become nuanced and subtle and to command the detail, because throughout most of his career, when he's been in a tight spot, he's changed the subject. And you can't do that at the moment. There's only one subject now, which is the pandemic. So I think he's having to get a grip on the detail, actually. And I think he's such an unscrupulous character that I think he will. And I think Keir Starmer will be very much the schoolmaster forcing him to do his prep, which actually his teachers at Eton and Balliol couldn't. He didn't ever become as professional a classicist as he should have done, because he would not do the work. Now he's going to be made to do the work. It's the only way in which he will be able to withstand Keir Starmer in the House of Commons.
Well, that comes, Ayesha, to this quite interesting theory that has been doing the rounds, that maybe all the confused and apparently confusing and mixed messaging may not have been a cock-up, but possibly even deliberate, in the sense of that way you can say that to people out of this mess that, oh, you know, yes, if you did take the message, you were meant to get back to work. Well, that wasn't our fault. That was, you drew that conclusion yourself. In other words, this is a kind of deniable nudge towards ending the lockdown. And therefore, if it goes wrong, you can always say we didn't mean for people to take that advice. Do you buy that? Or do you think this is not some conspiratorial plan by the nudge unit or Downing Street Communications, but is rather just a cock up?
I think a conspiracy theory is probably a bit too far, but the function of government, and if you seek the highest office in the land to be Prime Minister, which Boris Johnson has been seeking most of his adult life, your primary duty as the Premier of this country is to protect life. I mean, that is the kind of number one priority. So I don't think it's good enough. And I really, really hope that there isn't a sense deep in number 10 that actually we can kind of, you know, cover our backs if we try and kind of spread the blame and the culpability and the responsibility with the public. It's worse from a communications point of view, and it's worse from a psychological point of view in terms of managing the public, to sort of release people into freedom and then put them back in. We've all done quite a good job of going into lockdown because of the government's very clear messaging to release people and then to say, actually, it's all gone a bit wrong, go back inside. That is going to be really, really hard.
Let's get on to the business of the relationship between the two parties and how they're interacting with each other, particularly the style, the decisions that Keir Starmer and Labour have taken. He has opted for so-called constructive opposition and decided that's his approach. I just wonder, Andrew, as somebody who's watched Johnson so closely, whether he would almost prefer a kind of another blusterer across to oppose him, a fellow blusterer, if you like, rather than have one of these quiet, detail forensic guys opposite him in the form of Keir Starmer.
Well, he's got to deal with what's there. Obviously, a much more formidable opponent than Jeremy Corbyn was in the House of Commons, and I think he'll very much want to bind Starmer in, and he'll thank him for the constructive tone in which the question's being put. He won't want to pick a fight with him, but yeah, no, it's going to be one nation conservatism, I think, all pulling together, and particular. I mean, it plugs into what he was hoping to do already, which is reach Labour voters.
But that all works. That works well in tone. I get that. But when you're being pressed on detail, numbers, line by line, regulations, etc., that's not his comfort zone.
Ever since I've watched him, and I've actually, oddly enough, I've known him since 1987, and I've watched his entire political career. He has become more professional, and some of his opponents have underestimated that. During the referendum, he won it, stuck to the message. During the last general election in December, he was incredibly on message. Don't underestimate him. I think that would be my advice.
And Ayesha, on the Labour side, partly because of what Andrew's just said, there have been some people who are worried, aren't they, about Starmer's approach, this sort of quiet, professional, sotto voce style of opposition, rather than him being more combative. What's the debate as you pick it up inside Labour at the moment about whether Starmer's getting it right or not?
On the whole, I think people feel that he has got off to a good start. His Prime Minister's questions have been just, you know, they've come as a huge relief to people because they felt that, you know, we really haven't been well represented at the dispatch box for a very long time, having had Jeremy Corbyn. And I think he's gained a lot of respect and he's quelled a lot of his critics. I do think that if Parliament ever returns to any semblance of normality, i.e. a lot of noise, that will again put Boris Johnson at an advantage because he, of course, loves playing to a crowd and the Tories, you know, are very, very noisy. He's not yet had to cope with that wall of noise. And when you are preparing people for Prime Minister's questions, that's one of the most difficult things to try and deal with, all the heckling, all of that type of thing. Now, in terms of his standing within the party, there are some who have felt that he hasn't quite been as assertive enough. He's aping a very different style from recent Labour Party mantra, which is, you know, resign, you know, call for a judge-led inquiry and denounce everybody at every twist and turn. It's a difficult start to his leadership, but in a way, new leaders of the opposition often struggle to define themselves. There is only one story in town. That gives him definition. I thought the intervention he made on Friday on VE Day was very, very artful. He managed to get a splash.
In the Telegraph.
Boris Johnson's old paper. And he went in on big themes, patriotism, but he did it in a way which was quite clever, I thought, which was through a genuine Labour issue, which was social care and looking after people in those kind of homes. So I think that's the kind of interventions which will serve him well.
I just wonder what Tories make of this strategy of Starmer's. On the one hand, you know, he's leaving it to others. He's leaving it to the Piers Morgans and others to do the day-to-day going for the government's jugular. And whether Tories think Starmer's missing a trick here, or do they worry that if all this does play out very badly over the next year or so, he's going to look like a very plausible alternative leader of the country who wasn't, jumping and pouncing on every misstep, but instead looked kind of statesmanlike. How are Tories reading the choices he's making?
No, I think the Tories are not likely to make the error of underestimating him. He does look much more prime ministerial than Jeremy Corbyn, and I think actually more prime ministerial than Ed Miliband did. Most Tories would think, for the sake of the country, it's absolutely essential to have a convincing alternative government there. And I think he will win. He has much greater respect of Labour MPs who know him, on the whole, know him best. So, I mean, that is all a very, very good thing, actually.
Let me ask both of you to gaze into the crystal ball a bit and imagine how politics will be once this has passed. I know that becomes very difficult. It was striking to me that Ayesha a moment ago talked about if Parliament comes back rather than when. Do we believe that somehow politics will have changed and that there'll be an appetite for a more consensual, in a way, Keir Starmer-like politics? Or do we think as soon as politics comes back properly and that this is behind us, the old normal kicks in, as it were?
I think there will actually be an appetite for a slightly more moderate style of politics. I think, and I'm somebody who loves the rowdiness of the chamber. I like the theatre of the chamber, but I have noticed that a lot of people have been tuning into Prime Minister's questions. And because the temperature has been lower and with the video conferencing, you can actually hear the questions properly that are being asked. You can hear the answers given properly. A lot of people have actually quite liked it and, you know, felt that it's professionalised politics a bit. So I think there probably will be a bit of an appetite for that. The interesting thing, though, I think for particularly people on the left, and in fact, people of all, you know, political hues to watch, is will this virus and the impact, will it shift what the, you know, mythical haloed centre ground is? There's a lot of hope, and I think some of it is a bit naive on the left, that suddenly we're going to come out of this and everybody is going to sort of thirst a socialist government. Remember, we still have Brexit hanging over us. People are still very wedded to the concept of Brexit and the culture war that entailed as well. So it's going to be really fascinating to see how politics in this country changes and what the kind of common sense centre ground sort of remit is and whether that changes.
I don't think it will spring back to what it was. I hope as soon as possible the House of Commons will be full of people again, because then you can really get some feeling for how parliamentary opinion is moving. And parliamentary opinion does usually reflect public opinion. And we can't get that at the moment with this rather disembodied form of parliamentary proceedings. So that's very important. At that point, I think, because Keir Starmer will keep his head and know what he wants to say, he may well show up any Tory hooligans who try to howl him down. So I think actually he might do well in a full chamber. Also, if he's actually saying things which are worth saying, then people will want to hear. Johnson, however, the Tories have walked off, and they've been doing this at least since 2010. They've walked off with a lot of Labour seats and Labour voters, and they're really going to try and hold on to those seats by trying to convince sort of voters in northern former Labour seats that they're actually better off with the Tories. He will still be trying to persuade Labour voters that actually they'll be better off and living in a more dynamic and richer country, which can therefore afford a better NHS than if they go for Starmer.
So much of whether they hold on to these red wall seats will be dependent on what follows next. If there is going to be more austerity, will there be the money to make good on all the pre-election promises and even the pre-pandemic budget, which was turning on the spending taps in the north and the infrastructure projects? You know, we don't even know right now if all that money is going to be there. I mean, the economic geography could look very, very different, and not one that the Prime Minister necessarily wants, because he does want to sort of keep those seats. So I think that's where the fight is going to be, and that's where things are going to be very interesting, because there will be an ideological difference in what the Conservatives want to do and what Labour proposes. And there's no doubt that there will be some austerity in what the Conservatives propose. And that's where we're going to have a rerun of that kind of argument, which will be interesting.
Well, I understand that you're hoping for austerity. It's not a word that Johnson will even allow to pass his lips. And I think the Keynesian wisdom is that at a time like this, you have to pour in liquidity, you have to pour in investment. Otherwise, you have a self-devouring sort of death spiral. So austerity will not be what either Johnson or Rishi Sunak are offering, I don't think.
Well, just because the word isn't used, Andrew, it doesn't mean that the effects may not be there. I mean, time will tell, but, you know, they're already saying that they're going to have to turn the furlough scheme off earlier than a lot of people are.
Well, they actually want people to get back to work. They want the economy to start up again.
Of course, we all do, but you can't send people out to work when it's unsafe and when other people are still at home and there isn't a market for their goods and services.
I'm going to jump in there because we're straying beyond our immediate topic and into questions that, of course, we're going to return to again. For now, Aisha Hazarika and Andrew Jimson, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, on the 7th of May, Londoners were meant to go to the polls and vote for their choice for mayor of the capital. But like so many other events, the coronavirus outbreak forced the authorities to delay the election until 2021. That signalled the end of Rory Stewart's campaign. The former Tory MP, who had decided to run as an independent, explained that he just couldn't ask volunteers to work unpaid for another year, and he simply couldn't go up against the Labour and Tory machines. Now, as it happens, this year marks the 20th anniversary of the first time Londoners were able to elect a mayor for the city. The Guardian columnist Simon Jenkins was part of the movement for a directly elected leader of the capital, and he now looks back on two decades of London mayoral elections. He spoke to us from the west coast of Wales, overlooking the beautiful estuary of the River Dyfi, or as he likes to call it, paradise. If you listen closely, you might be able to hear the tide come in.
What happened 20 years ago was that London, for the first time in its history, actually elected itself a mayor. It had had many sorts of leaders over the centuries, but it had never had a directly elected mayor like most cities in the world do have. So London did make this great new move, and having been part of the campaign to achieve it, I was very excited. I was chairman of something called the Commission for Local Democracy back in the early 1990s, and we proposed, as a way of galvanising local government in Britain, which was in need of galvanising, that one way of doing it was to increase the personality, the profile, so to speak, of local civic leaders by having directly elected mayors. Prior to that, the leader of the local council was always the leader of the majority party in an election, which meant they were always party politicians and tended to behave as leaders, as if they were leaders of a party rather than leaders of the whole city. We wanted someone who would be elected leader of the whole of London and represent the city as such.
Madam Speaker, I've had various meetings with ministers today to discuss the implementation of our election pledges.
We persuaded Tony Blair, then in opposition, this would be a good reform for him to introduce if he got into power. And he put it in the manifesto in 1997. He honoured that particular clause in his manifesto, and in 1999 passed an Act of Parliament instituting an elected governor for London. And so it was in 1999 that the Act was passed. It was in 2000 that the election took place.
Good evening. After an historic election, counting is now underway to find out who's the first mayor directly elected by the people of London.
No one had ever thought of running for mayor of London before. It was always a, frankly, rather characterless, uninteresting person, apart from the last leader of the council, who was abolished by Margaret Thatcher in 1995, called Ken Livingstone, who was a very left-wing, rather difficult character at the time. And people like Richard Branson and Alan Sugar. I was part of the general swirl of publicity at the time, and it was curious to see people who, frankly, I thought out of vanity rather than anything else, thought it would be fun to run for mayor. In the end, it was rather a boring lineup. But the great irony was that the person who wanted to stand for Labour, which was Ken Livingstone, was not allowed to, was rejected by the Labour Party, so he stood as independent. And even bigger irony was that Ken Livingstone was elected. In other words, the person who'd been leading London under the old party system became the leader of London under the new mayoral system.
Therefore, the two candidates who received the highest number of such votes remain in the contest. They are Boris Johnson and Ken Livingstone.
What was interesting was in 2008, after Ken Livingstone had served two terms as mayor, with some success, I may say, he was, I think, in many ways, the most successful mayor we've had. He didn't achieve an awful lot, but he did establish the job. He stood a third time, I think unwisely, in 2008, where he was challenged by an as yet rather unsuccessful journalist turned local MP for Henley called Boris Johnson, who I think quite brazenly saw the job as a stepping stone back into frontline politics at the national level, which I may say is what mayors tend to do in most democracies. And he did, I have to say, do unbelievably well. London is not overwhelmingly a conservative city, so to be a conservative candidate for mayor is difficult anyway, but to be a conservative candidate in 2008 was quite remarkable.
I therefore officially declare Boris Johnson to be elected as the next mayor of London.
And he beat Ken Livingstone fair and square. I think Livingstone was very upset and became, for the first time really, a genuinely national figure. He was now mayor of London and he was looking forward to great things, I think.
The initiative's been christened Boris's Bikes after the capital's cycle-mad mayor. Commuters who
I think Boris Johnson, when he came to the post, really... He had very little interest in London. He really wanted to make a personal crusade of the job. He was obsessed with publicity, self-publicity. He attached the word Boris to almost everything. He was the leader of the city during the Olympics, which was very important. He invented a lot of bicycle ways and new bicycle schemes. He was crazy about spending money on vanity projects, a new sort of London bus, which never worked. A zip wire across the river, a garden bridge across the river. Many of these things didn't work. But what he did do is he established the post of mayor as being a significant place in the political firmament. And those of us who wanted the mayor to work wanted above all to make it, so to speak, unabolishable. And I think Ken Livingstone and then Boris Johnson made it unabolishable. There's no doubt at all that Boris Johnson was able to use it as a stepping stone back into politics, which, of course, he did after two terms. And to that extent, I have to say, he was quite successful.
I therefore declare Sadiq Khan to be elected as the new mayor of London.
I think when Sadiq Khan took over, he was not a charismatic personality in the way that Boris Johnson was. He found it difficult to find things to do, which is a general problem with the mayor. And he never really appeared to replace Boris Johnson in the post. He still remains something of an unknown figure. I would really like to see the Mayor of London become as significant a figure as the Mayor of New York has always been. Most mayors of most big capital cities have, and they do, wield serious power. The London Mayor under Livingstone, Johnson and Khan has never actually wielded that kind of power. So I'd like to see the new mayor be someone who's frankly ambitious for the city and for the post of mayor. And for that to happen, I think they need to be a politician of national stature, as I think Rory Stewart might have become, sadly he stood down, such that it isn't just the mayor of London, it's the mayor of the future of London that we would hope to see.
The Guardian's Simon Jenkins. And that's all from us this week. Before we finish up, I want to say thank you to all of you who've supported us to date. The Guardian's open journalism connects us and brings us together when we need it most. But today, our advertising revenue and newspaper sales are falling faster than ever before, which means we need your support more than ever. Your contributions will sustain us and make sure that our open journalism stays open during this crisis and beyond. So if you'd like to help, please do visit gu.com/support podcasts. But for now, I want to thank our guests, Peter Walker, Simon Jenkins, Aisha Hazarika, and Andrew Jimson. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please do take care of yourselves, and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.